Welcome to the podcast for the Journal of the American Academy of Physician Assistants.
Welcome to the JAPA podcast for the September 2018 issue. In this podcast, we summarize select articles from this month's JAPA. I'm your co-host, Adrian Banning, faculty member, research coordinator, and EBM course director at the Drexel PA program in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
And I'm your other co-host, Christopher Madej, program director at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center PA program in Memphis, Tennessee. I am ready for fall, Adrian. I am done with summer. I don't know about you, but I am glad that I'm starting to see September in things.
I'm only going to second that right now because my central air is broken, but I am forever summer girl. Pumpkin spice is kind of like the harbinger of doom to me.
Well, and I think you and I have completely different ideas of what winter are. Philadelphia winter is not Memphis winter, but I am ready. But I will also say that Memphis summers are not Philadelphia summers.
Well, yeah, I guess we're both living with different extremes, I just feel like there's so much more like freedom in summer. You don't have to put 45 layers on and make sure you've got the right shoes. You just slap some flip-flops and sunscreen on, and out you go.
That's true. That's very true. Yeah. So this month, we are going to talk about ALS and idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. We're also going to talk about a QRS on abnormal uterine bleeding and a review article on the diagnosis and management of complicated appendicitis.
True, true, true. But before that, we are going to address Harrison Reed's question from the editor. This is a great one. I'm really excited to talk about it. So this is what Harrison asks us. Due to a catastrophic medication shortage, you will be limited to only 3 medications to use in your medical practice for the next year. Which 3 medications will you use to serve your patient population and why? Chris, what did you say?
All right, so here's my big 3. I've got hydrochlorothiazide because I think that a good, cheap diuretic is probably going to get most people by. Maybe not the best, but for 1 year, I can probably control somebody's blood pressure pretty well with hydrochlorothiazide. Insulin, just because so I started thinking, all right, what are the things that I'm really going to have to manage? So hypertension, diabetes, I was like, this is going to be a huge component. And even if somebody's not ready for insulin, it can at least be used. And if patients who are type 1 are difficult to control, it should work too. So for short term, 1 year, insulin, hydrochlorothiazide, get me by. And then my favorite drug of all time, no matter what, which is why I got excited about this, is doxycycline. My antibiotic of choice is doxycycline because it treats all tick-borne illnesses. It can be used for malaria prophylaxis. It can be used for MRSA treatment. It can be used for community-acquired pneumonia. It can be used for sexually transmitted infections. And in the off chance that this catastrophic medicine shortage leads to something else, it can be used to treat the plague, as well as tularemia, should you be around bunnies. So doxycycline is like, if somebody told me...
Should you be around bunnies?
Yeah. So doxycycline is one of those that if I had one antibiotic to choose, that's my go-to because it can be used to treat so many different things. And I figured that would get me by from an antibiotic standpoint. So those are my big 3. What about you?
Okay. I thought about those things too. I thought, hypertension, diabetes, and some type of antibiotic. But then more so, I thought, could we just get by for a year? Kind of, I don't know, unmanaged and just dealing with emergencies and pain. You only have 3 meds total. So my number 1 is oral contraceptives. We can't have half the population not being able to control whether they want to get pregnant or not. Mm-hmm. Not a political statement, just an important medication. It's used for more than just birth control as well. Mm-hmm. Number 1, birth control. Number 2, I just chose penicillin. Not going to cover plague or malaria prophylaxis. I assumed that I was going to be staying in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia, but so I would need that for Lyme. We have tons and tons of Lyme disease here, but still, I chose penicillin, and I was hoping that I also have a dietitian on hand and maybe some good counseling about tick identification and removal to maybe manage hypertension and diabetes with diet and exercise during that year just getting by. So number two, I chose penicillin. And then number three, I just thought, well, I didn't know if it was prescription or all medication, so I just wanted an NSAID on hand, so I chose ibuprofen, knowing that pain, lower back pain, headaches are the one and two most common primary care chief complaints. I thought it might just be nice to have a little bit of pain control, at least an NSAID on board. So they're my three. Harrison, good question.
Yeah, no. I like that. I had fun with this one because doxy was, I mean, that just came to mind right off the bat. And then I had to really think about the other two. But no, I thought that's a good question to kind of get the cerebral juices flowing, so to speak.
Yeah, I think I had to go back to primary prevention a little bit more too and think, if we really didn't have these things, we could be doing a better job with that stuff. But that doesn't mean that we can't be doing it now.
Right,
so.
Right. Mm-hmm. All right, so let's jump into it. So our standard disclaimer, so this podcast is a summary of selected articles from this month's edition, and we share our take, Agent and my's take, on and our opinions, but they don't represent JAPA, the authors, the editors, the publisher. It isn't intended as medical advice.
Right. Just two people talking at you. Okay, so we're going to jump into the CME first. And here's our standard reminder about CME. If you read both CME articles, review the post-test, and then take the online test at cme.aapa.org, you need to get at least 70% on both of them, and then you get one, Category 1 CME. So don't forget, go and take that test.
That's right.
Our first CME article is about amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, otherwise known as ALS, which we're going to be calling it for the remainder of this review. So it's a guide to collaborative care by author Carrie Smith-Nold, PhD, and she's an assistant professor and didactic coordinator of the PA program at the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine, but not here in Philadelphia, way down closer to you, actually, Chris, in Georgia campus in Suwanee?
Yep.
Georgia. And Ms. Smith-Nold has disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. So this is really a review, an overview for primary care providers on ALS and a highlight of the role that primary care providers have in identifying and managing it and organizing care, especially when disease progression limits how much the person can travel towards the end of their disease process. The author does not say that primary care providers are going to be managing this disease alone, and she's really careful to say that neurologists are pivotal in the diagnosis and care of this patient with ALS, but it's a nice review coming up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what you need to know about ALS is that death usually occurs within 2 to 4 years after diagnosis, so quick diagnosis and identification and then referral and planning carefully right away is really important, and that's where the primary care providers come in. Or what if you're a surgical PA or a derm PA, or you're just a friend or a family member, you still might be the first person to recognize some of these signs and symptoms. So even if you're not primary care, or even if you're not neuro, this is still a good review for you. Don't tune out yet. So everyone, listen up. What is ALS? It is a motor neuron disease. It's a disease of the upper and lower motor neurons. These motor neurons die, and we don't know why. 5 to 10% of ALS is familial, but most of it is not, 90 to 95%. We know some of the biochemical how, but not why. The article goes into more detail on that. And just a little timeout reminder, if you haven't said upper or lower motor neurons since PA school, lower motor neurons go from the spinal cord to the muscle, get the muscle moving. Problems with them increase flaccidity, decrease ability of the muscle to contract, so you get weakness. And upper motor neurons go from the spinal cord then to the brain in the movement pathway. So problems there increase spasticity. And you test both of those things in the complete arc loop when you test deep tendon reflexes. So if you get a positive deep tendon reflex, you know that the lower motor neuron to the spinal cord and then upper motor neuron from the spinal cord to the brain and then back around again, afferent and efferent, are both working like they should, and that beautiful, elegant circuit. And when you're doing your deep tendon reflexes or DTRs, lower motor neuron disease is decreased reflexes and upper motor neuron disease is increased reflexes. Okay, so now just a little time back in. ALS is more common in white men. The mean age of onset is at age 62, and then increases in incidence up to around age 74. So after age 74, we start to see people not being diagnosed as much. The incidence in general has been increasing since the 1950s, but not to panic, because it might be that we're just better at identifying it. So previously in the 50s, someone may have had ALS, but we called it something else or just didn't even give it a name. So it was always there at this rate, and now we're just more able to kind of see it. However, if there is a true incidence increase, it might be because of different environmental factors. And the article doesn't say it specifically, so I looked it up on ALS.org, and they suggest that the incidence, and so that's how many new cases a year per certain amount of people there are, they say that the incidence is about 2 cases per 100,000 people per year. So it's still pretty rare. What are the risk factors? Smoking is a known risk factor. Less strong evidence supports military service, agricultural work, weirdly being athletic, heavy metal exposure, metals, not music, and pesticide exposure. And also, kind of weirdly, there are these ALS clusters, and they happen in Guam, Japan, and New Guinea. So ask about that in your patient's history. How are they going to present? Usually asymmetric weakness, and usually lower motor neuron symptoms first, but not always. The disease doesn't read the textbook. You might have muscle cramping, weakness, hyporeflexia, so decreased reflexes, muscle atrophy, fasciculations, or if it's upper motor neuron, increased reflexes, including pectoralis and gag reflexes and jaw jerk reflexes. Again, you might see weakness, clonus, spasticity, and the author points out, don't forget to check the tongue too. It might be time to pull out your Bates textbook for a quick review of those exams if it's been a while. Mm-hmm. You want to look for, it's always good to go back to the basics, right?
Yep.
Just a little review.
One of my favorite books ever.
It makes a lot more sense when you read it, maybe at the end of didactic year, during your clinical year, and definitely then after you've been practicing for a while. But I think a lot of us first go to it at the very beginning when you're like, I don't even know any medicine.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, if you still have your Bates, I think you're going to appreciate it more than you ever have. Okay. You might also see dysarthria or dysphagia as presenting symptoms, or at least at the beginning, or foot drop. And so you want to make sure that you're not just misdiagnosing this as like a distal nerve injury. Muscle pain generally comes later with cramping, but emotional changes can come later, cognitive impairment, behavioral impairment, and maybe even frontotemporal dementia. So it's not just all physical. And obviously this is an incredibly taxing disease on everyone. So lots of therapy and support. We're going to get to that later in treatment. Okay, there's a great review of differentials in table 1 of this article. Make sure you're ruling those things out before you decide that it's ALS. And as primary care, you're probably not going to be the one making the final call, but you want to think about myasthenia gravis. There, weakness improves with rest, but not in ALS. You want to think about multifocal motor neuropathy. There, motor nerve conduction studies will show conduction block, and they don't usually in ALS. That's one way to differentiate it. Also, multifocal motor neuropathy responds to IV immunoglobulin therapy, and ALS does not. Think about an inflammatory myopathy. You can use a muscle biopsy to differentiate that from ALS. And finally, check to see that there isn't a cervical myelopathy and that you would just need an MRI of the spinal cord to look for nerve compression. There's not one great way to diagnose this, but you might get started to help exclude differentials, especially if the person's waiting to see neurology. You can order serum creatinine kinase while you're waiting, MRI of the brain and spinal cord, and any of the other labs that you have access to above that we mentioned. A neurologist might want an EMG. Your EMG, the person doing the study and interpreting it, should be experienced. Think about that. Cerebral spinal fluid, ESR, because why not? Serum and urine protein electrophoresis, thyroid studies, B12, because remember, B12 and folate deficiencies can cause peripheral neuropathies or movement. ANA, rapid plasma, reagent, serum calcium, heavy metal levels, HIV screening, T-cell lymphotrophic virus, Lyme disease. It's becoming more and more common, and anti-GM, ganglioside antibodies. Also, if you're thinking myasthenia gravis, acetylcholine receptor antibody panel. So, phew, there's a lot to order, but a lot you can help the neurologist with while you're getting them going. Okay, so if you diagnose someone with ALS, there is some small amount of evidence that an ALS clinic might help improve mortality, not a ton. If you have access to one, it seems like a great resource. Obviously, there's no cure, so we're really focused on quality of life and patient and caregiver family support. You're going to want, obviously, a neurologist involved. I'm sorry I keep saying obviously. Maybe it's not obvious, and that's why we're reading this. So you're going to want a neurologist involved. All the therapists you can pull together, speech, OT, psychological, PT. The article says you might want to bring in a nutritionist, but I think they probably mean dietitian, nutritionists and dietitians, different people. Think about the nutritional support of this patient is the takeaway message. Think about consulting GI and pulmonary too. There are two disease-modifying treatments. Again, they're not cures. The first is riluzole, and that might increase life for 3 to 21 months is what the evidence says. And then the second, just approved last year in 2017, has evidence to support its efficacy only in a small subset of patients, those people with early stage definite or probable ALS, and they're not exactly sure how it helps the rest of the ALS population yet. The article does go into more symptomatic support. Definitely check the article for more about that, especially if you're the PCP managing this person once their ability to travel to a specialist might be limited. So all in all, it's not too common, but it's devastating and important to catch as soon as you can so that the person can start to make plans with their family and their caregivers so that you can make sure it's not something else. So kind of a lot like dementia, we're not going to necessarily stop this, but to get all the support in place that you can, kind of sadly knowing what's coming is going to be really helpful.
Yep, yep. And Stephen Hawking just passed away in March of this year from ALS and had that disease for a very long time. So it's
totally unusual.
Very unusual. And, you know, it's good to see, but it also, the perception is then it's a disease that you can really function with. But he had a lot. It was a rare case. Had a lot of things that was able to help him progress, which not everybody is going to have.
Exactly.
And but it's a good review article, especially with, you know, the ALS challenge that had come out a few years ago that kind of brought some public awareness to it. It's nice to see some literature to back that up as well.
I agree. Did you do it? Did you do the Ice Bucket Challenge?
I did. Mm-hmm. I got challenged. It was by some students of mine, so it was fun.
They're good for that.
It was fun, yeah. And Lou Gehrig's disease. It is Lou Gehrig's disease for those of you
if you are wondering.
That like to like eponyms, which I do.
For those of you who like eponyms.
Yep, yep. All right.
You're going to start a club soon.
So the next one we're going to talk about is, full disclosure, a disease that I did not know a lot about. I do not know a lot about idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. So this was a good review article for those of us that maybe don't work in a pulmonology clinic or see these patients all that often. So this article was written by Daniel Preventure, who is an assistant professor and clinical coordinator at Midwestern University in Illinois, and Andrew, I'm sorry if I'm going to butcher this, Jarijui? Honestly, I have no phonetic way to be able to pronounce this, so Andrew, I'm sorry.
Let's just spell it so that he gets
credit. J-A-U-R-E-G-U-I.
I can't even begin. Nope. So, Andrew, I'm sure you get this, but we props.
Yep, yep. Shout out to Andrew, who was a student at the time it was written at Midwestern. So what is the definition of idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis? This is a progressive lung disease characterized by a pattern of scarring of the lung, the lung interstitium, and leading to progressive decline in overall lung function. And despite decades of research, it is still fairly poorly understood, but it's generally agreed that there are three mechanisms of pathogenesis. The first is repeated micro-injury to the lung epithelium, and this can be due to smoke, dust, recurrent infections, even GERD with microaspirations, but something that's just going to sort of be slowly poking at the lung over time. They also have abnormal wound healing responses, and typically this is due to dysregulation of cytokines and a whole bunch of different growth factors, platelet-derived growth factor, fibroblast growth factor, a whole bunch of other sort of cellular levels of dysregulation, as well as genetic susceptibility. So those are the three general mechanisms that are agreed upon. How do you see these patients? They tend to be a very insidious, progressive onset of dyspnea and dry cough that has typically been present for greater than 6 months. They can also have signs of right-sided heart failure with pulmonary hypertension in long-standing cases, which, again, this can also be called cor pulmonale. The diagnosis is made by several different tiers. First, we're going to do some laboratory studies, and this revolves around more autoimmune screening because there's a lot of different autoimmune conditions that can have lung manifestations that can mirror this. So you want to at least screen for those to either rule them out or rule them in as a possible cause. You want to order pulmonary function testing, and typically what you see is a decline in the forced vital capacity, or the FVC, which is typically 150 to 200 milliliters per year on average. We see this decline. And then your imaging studies, where you're going to do a high-resolution CT scan, and what you're typically going to see are bibasal or subpleural bronchiectasis and honeycomb. Sometimes you can see some ground glass opacities, as well as microconsolidation, micronodules, discrete cysts, and air trapping. The lung biopsy is really not needed. It used to be what we would go to just to get some tissue diagnosis, but they found that there's really not a lot of evidence to support that being any better than just laboratory screening and imaging screening. So how do we treat this? First and foremost, like with anything, we want to try to avoid as much lung injury as possible. So if they're smoking, tell them to stop. If they're around any kind of noxious fumes or other inhaled issues, then we want them to stop that because we want to stop that micro injury. Pulmonary rehabilitation has also been very, very key in increasing quality of life and maintaining activity. So you would get with your local therapies and find out what exactly you need to do to get your patients to qualify for that. You're going to want to start supplemental oxygen because the oxygen can be very helpful in maintaining quality of life, very similar to COPD patients. But remember, there are Medicare qualifications in order to qualify for that, which is typically going to be a pulse oximeter reading of less than 89% at rest, or slightly higher if they have other signs and symptoms, such as signs of right heart failure, elevations in their red blood cell counts, or just other signs that would signify that longstanding hypoxemia is present. We want to do the immunizations. So all of the standard immunizations, flu, streptococcal, every year to make sure that they're protected from the infectious standpoint. And then what do you do in terms of exacerbations? We typically will do some kind of broad-spectrum antibiotics to treat perceived bacterial infections. And then also high-dose corticosteroids, which are typically 1 mg/kg per day. And the data right now is split on how long you need to do that for and what degree of taper you need to do. But both of those will get you by for an acute exacerbation. From a medical management standpoint, there are two FDA-approved drugs. There is pirfenidone, which decreases fibroblast proliferation, and there's nintedanib, which is a tyrosine kinase receptor blocker and inhibits fibroblast differentiation and reduces collagen production, so it helps with some of that scarring at the lung level. Transplantation is also available, and single lung is actually the gold standard right now because, one, it's readily available, then double lung transplants. But the mean survival after transplant is still only 5.3 years, so it is not curative by any means. Prognosis, this disease has a fairly high mortality rate overall, higher if you see a decline in FVC of greater than 10% in the first 6 months after diagnosis, if you see a decline in their diffusion capacity of greater than 15% on PFTs, or if they have an oxygen desaturation of less than 88% on a 6-minute walk test. If they have pulmonary hypertension or if they have any other hospitalizations due to respiratory decline. So if your patients have any of these, then it's going to make it a little bit harder road for recovery and management. So not a very common disease, but it's going to be common in certain patient populations. You need to keep a lookout for it because I can see how it would be very easy to miss this or call this just recurrent pulmonary infections. So you have to keep it on your radar to make sure that you're screening appropriately.
I learned that lung biopsy isn't needed. This kind of sticks out to me because it was the first case that I saw on my first rotation as a PA student, which was surgery. A young person had some ongoing breathing trouble, and finally it came to be that it was idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, and I got to make the first cut, talk to the person, and then also make the cut during the person's lung biopsy. And if you don't have to have that done, it seems like a nice thing while you're already dealing with something pretty difficult to not have to go through.
That's so right. Yeah. Yeah. So good review article.
When we know better, we do better. Okay. We're going to go on to the QRS about abnormal uterine bleeding. And this article was written by Elise Watkins, who was an assistant professor at the PA program at High Point in North Carolina, High Point University. She has disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. And so basically, abnormal uterine bleeding, or AUB, as we're going to call it from now on, is bleeding from the uterus that is irregular in duration, volume, or frequency and is not happening during pregnancy. During their period, most women lose from less than 4 milliliters to more than 14 milliliters of blood. So now I'm going to get an aside for a second, and this is not what the author had written, just my own personal take here. I don't know anyone who measures this in any way. An indicator is if a woman has to change pads or tampons hourly during the first few days of her period, that would be a lot of bleeding. I wouldn't ask how many pads or tampons someone uses unless you know what you're going to do with that information. Sometimes it gets taught as something to ask in history, but if someone says 3 or 45, I mean, you might assume that 45 is a lot, but otherwise, if you don't know, then, I guess never ask anything if you don't know what you're going to do with the information, but I was just reading an article in Popular Science about how NASA, who was even initially concerned that periods could preclude you from going into space travel, which it does not, asked astronaut Sally Ride in 1983. She was going into space for a week for 7 days. And NASA said, Sally Ride, is 100 tampons going to be enough for you? Is that the right amount? And she said, no, that is not the right amount. That is incredibly excessive. That's 14.2 tampons a day.
Good.
That's
night.
Too many. That's too good night. That's too many. If someone is using 14.2 tampons a day, let's call that excessive. Yes. But
you could be an astronaut.
If you're going into space, you want to travel light. You probably need at least half that amount, is what she said. Also, a little soapbox. Sometimes I hear medical providers who don't happen to have a uterus say, I don't know about this stuff. I don't live with it. I don't know. Well, I mean, it's 50% of the population. You could ask someone. I know about prostates and I don't have one. Okay. Now back to the article. Okay. We say excessive uterine bleeding, quote unquote, now to describe bleeding that interferes with quality of life. Instead of the terms menometroraja or menorrhagia, you probably remember taking tests with those terms on it and you were like, wait, which one's too much? Which one's irregular? Now we're just going to say excessive uterine bleeding and make it simpler for everyone. Thank goodness. It can be acute AUB if you have to treat it quickly to prevent hemodynamic compromise. So how do you know if it's AUB or acute AUB? Like, do you have to do something right now so that the person doesn't have some type of bleeding out problem? All right, so first check if the patient is of reproductive age. The differential is different if they haven't had their first period yet or if they are menopausal. And again, side note, postmenopausal bleeding, if you happen to see this on any test, is uterine cancer until proven otherwise, or you see it in real life, which is, more important. The most common causes of AUB are polyps, adenomyosis, leiomyoma, malignancy, or hyperplasia, coagulopathy. Actually, up to 20% of people with AUB have a bleeding disorder. Keep that in mind. Other causes are ovulatory dysfunction, endometrial causes, iatrogenic, or just not classified. So in your history, ask about pregnancies and deliveries. Ask about surgical and sexual history, risk of bleeding disorders, and history of cancers. Ask about any history of unopposed estrogen use, oral contraceptives, levothyroxine, or anticoagulant use. If you're thinking that it might be cancer, that bleeding is usually painless. Leiomyomas, however, have some pain in painful sex or maybe a feeling of abdominal or pelvic fullness. On exam, you want to look for any other places the bleeding could be coming from. Aside from the uterus, check for pregnancy, check for von Willebrand with von Willebrand antigen, factor 8, and risdiceton cofactor. And you might want to think about a transvaginal pelvic ultrasound or endometrial sampling, depending on how the person presents. The treatment has to target the cause specifically, and it might be meds like oral contraceptive pills, intrauterine levonorgestrel-containing devices like IUDs. It could be surgical, so endometrial ablation if the person does not want to have kids or they don't want to have any more kids. Don't do it if they do want kids or have having more kids. You might do a uterine artery embolization, or hysterectomy could be a last resort. As always in QRS, there's great multiple choice questions to review your knowledge of this. Take those two little questions. And that's something that I really love about the QRS section. I think this is a great overview of all the causes of AUB.
You're going to see it. And you need to have a good way to break down potential causes and what you're going to do in the short term versus the long term, and the specialists that you need to refer to if you're seeing this in the emergency room or in family practice or outpatient practice. It's common. It's very common.
Mm-hmm. But you can manage it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So
the review article we're going to cover today is Complicated Appendicitis and Considerations for Interval Appendectomy. And this was written by Kelly Sue Perez, who is a PA, and Stephen R. Allen, who is a physician. At the time, Ms. Perez practiced at the Division of Trauma, Acute Care, and Critical Care Surgery at Penn State's Milton S. Hershey Medical Center in Hershey, Pennsylvania. And she is now working in neurology in Las Vegas, Nevada. And Dr. Allen is an associate professor of surgery at Hershey Medical Center.
Well, they're different places.
Yep.
Hershey and Las Vegas.
A little bit. A little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, there's the line that you can draw, but it's a tough one. So what exactly does complicated mean? So appendicitis can be complicated if there is evidence of rupture with a subsequent abscess, or one of my favorite medical terms, phlegmon, formation that you see on imaging. If they've had symptoms for greater than 48 hours, if they the age of the patient is less than 3 or greater than 65, if they have a leukocytosis of greater than 16,000, or an elevated CRP of greater than 140 milligrams per deciliter. Complicated appendicitis accounts for 25% of appendectomies each year. So it's of the ones that we operate on, about a quarter of these are going to be complicated. Now, what does interval appendectomy mean? So this is when surgery is performed after the patient defervesces from their acute illness. So typically, this is going to be 8 to 12 weeks after their inciting symptoms. And we're going to treat them with IV antibiotics, possible CT-guided drainage of abscess or the phlegmon on imaging. And if the patient is greater than 40 years, we're going to be doing a screening colonoscopy, which we're going to get to here in a second. One of the things that the article talks about, which I really like because I use this a lot in my emergency medicine practice, is the Alvarado score. And you use this to help risk stratify patients who come in with suspected appendicitis. And the mnemonic that you want to remember is Mantrell's. So you have three symptoms, either migrating symptoms, anorexia, or nausea and vomiting. Each one of those gets a point. Physical exam findings, 2 points for tenderness in the right lower quadrant, 1 for rebound tenderness, and 1 for a fever. And then laboratory results, where you get 2 points for leukocytosis and 1 point for a left shift. Remember, left shift just means that you have elevations in the polymorphal nuclear cells or bands, not just that it's an elevated white blood cell count. This gives you a total score of 10. If it's greater than 7, it is a high likelihood that this is a appendicitis. 4 to 6 is equivocal, and you may need to do imaging, and less than 4 is low likelihood. Now, why would you want to do an interval appendectomy in somebody with appendicitis? So there's a couple different reasons. One, operating on somebody who's got a hot appendix, it makes the surgery a little bit more technically challenging because you've got a little bit of a firecracker in the right lower quadrant. So it's a higher likelihood that you can have an intraoperative rupture. And again, you're operating on somebody who may have some peritoneal signs. So giving them the opportunity to calm down a little bit from a physiologic standpoint and then do the operation later under controlled settings has actually shown to be of benefit in select patient populations. And typically these are going to be your younger patients who do very, very well with this. But the thing that I wanted to highlight that I took away from the article, which I think is really important when you start counseling your patients, is one of the things that you do in somebody who comes in with an appendicitis is sending the appendix off to pathology because it could possibly be a malignancy of the appendix that has caused the appendicitis. So in patients with complicated appendicitis, there's actually a higher incidence of neoplasm that has been diagnosed post-appendectomy, as well as a higher incidence of malignancy in older patients. So in two of the studies that the review article quoted, they saw that the incidence of neoplasm in interval appendectomy was actually anywhere from 29 to 55% of patients who came in with complicated appendicitis. So these were individuals who came in with an acute appendicitis, and then they went into doing IV antibiotics and getting them to Defravess, and then bringing them back 2 to 3 months later to do the appendectomy to find out that then they have cancer, which puts you 2 to 3 months behind the eight ball in terms of management. The mean age of these patients were 49. So again, not in the 60 range that you would expect to see malignancy in. So these are younger patients on the cancer side of things. And one of the studies, which actually really concerned me, was that they had two patients who had a complicated appendicitis who did not undergo interval appendectomy, either lost a follow-up or for whatever reason, but they didn't do the appendectomy at that time, came back to the hospital at some point later with stage four appendiceal cancer. So it's one of those things that's emerging right now in the surgery world of who do you operate on emergently, who do you do antibiotics on, and who do you bring back later. But the thing you want to keep in the back of your mind is you got to be thinking about cancer and screening. And that's where the screening colonoscopy comes in, is you can't really assess the appendix very well on colonoscopy, but you can see some of the pathology around the opening of the appendix. And the majority of your appendiceal cancers tend to be mucinous. And so you can actually see mucus production coming out of the opening of the appendix, which would raise your suspicion of doing surgery sooner than later. So a good review article, because I know in the ER, we were always torn talking with our surgery colleagues who in patients who came in with appendicitis of, who do we admit to surgery? Who do we just admit to the floor? Who gets what? And, I don't really think that this article really settled that debate, but just brought to light some of the things that you want to assess and some of the things that you want to be aware of, but also recognize the fact that, the surgery community at large is still kind of split on this, but really good article that highlighted some of those things.
I think it's just good to know, things are changing and we kind of have to keep an ear out. And right now, there's just not one way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
That was a good reminder. That about does it for us.
It surely does. It surely does. Mm-hmm. So sound and sound engineering are done by myself. And if you haven't subscribed to our feed, you should. And
yes,
you can do that on iTunes as well as our brand new Stitcher feed.
Stitcher.
Take a look at it. Give us a rating. Help us climb the ranks. You can tweet at myself at PA_Madey on Twitter. Adrian is at the Art of EBM, all one word. Japa mm-hmm. is at Japacom, as well as Harrison Reed, the associate editor and fervent supporter of our podcast, at Harrison Reed PA.
That's it for us this month. We hope to meet you back here next month. Thanks for tuning in.
October is PA month, so we'll see you back then.
That's right. Get your t-shirts ready.
That's right.
Bye.